Good morning. We had two cases scheduled this morning, but Henry has been removed from the list because of a quarantine in effect in Army Appellate Defense, leaving no one to represent the accused. So Henry will be heard with the other cases in October. The one case today is United States versus Garcia. Is the appellant ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
The government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant may argue.
Good morning, Chief Judge Suki, members of the court, and may it please the court. I am Captain David Bosner, and along with my co-counsel, Mr. Mark Brueger, we represent the appellant in this case, Senior Airman Caleb Garcia. Chief Judge Suki, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Granted.
The Air Force Court erred in at least three ways. First, the Air Force Court erred by inaccurately applying the abuse of discretion standard and not giving the military judge the deference she is entitled to under the prevailing case law. Second, the Air Force Court erred in finding the military judge abused her discretion related to her probable cause review, intentional falsity and reckless omissions of the affiants, and the application of the exclusionary rule. And third, the DNA evidence at issue is inadmissible as derivative of the already suppressed evidence in this case. The Air Force Court erred in finding the military judge abused her discretion when she found the second search was derivative of the first. And starting with derivative evidence, the entire second search must fail as it is derivative of the illegal search and seizure. Three entities are tainted in this case by the first illegality. First, the OSI agent, Special Agent Dunnigan. Second, the USASIL forensic biologist, Mr. Mark Torre. And third, the legal office that advised the special agent at the OSI detachment and helped apply for the search warrant. First, Agent Dunnigan is tainted for at least two reasons. He's the partner of Special Agent Bates, the agent who intentionally lied on her initial search application in this case.
Counsel, in terms of where you seem to be headed here, it's consistent with your brief. And in your brief, it seems to be a situation where you're saying that the individuals and the evidence become poisoned by its association with the poisonous fruit, rather than saying it is itself the poisonous fruit. Am I misunderstanding you?
No, Your Honor, I think that's exactly correct.
But is that the standard?
Your Honor, this search fails for several reasons. The first is that the players that are involved in application for the second search authorization are inherently intertwined in the first illegality and actually bring the information from the first illegality into their second application. And as we'll get to later, Your Honor, the second search fails on its own, for its own lack of probable cause, and for its own falsity, and for its own omissions. Now, when we look at the derivative...
But isn't the legal principle that the government gets to be set back to the space, the place it would have been, absent the illegality? It seems as if the military judge and you are now arguing that because of the illegality, anything that touched that illegality, anything that was involved or anyone, has become poisoned. So I'm just wondering again, where do you get that legal standard from in terms of precedent of this court, of the Supreme Court, or any of the circuit courts?
Yes, Your Honor, it's not quite as definitive as that stands. It's not that anyone who touched the case is now tainted, is now poisoned, and must fall away. The question that generates from Wong Sun is whether the taint is sufficiently dissipated. And in this case, the taint is not sufficiently dissipated as we move to search two. When we talk about Agent Dunnigan first, he is principally involved in the first illegality. He talks with Agent Bates about her affidavit before she applies for it. He doesn't discuss with her about her false statements. He doesn't prevent her.
I didn't see anything in the record, though, that indicated that Dunnigan knew that Bates had put that false information in there. Was I missing that in the record?
Your Honor, can you ask that one more time, please?
I didn't see anything in the record that indicated that Dunnigan knew that Bates had put false information in that first affidavit. Is there something in the record I've missed?
There are two points I'd like to direct your attention to, Your Honor. The first is that he failed to prevent Agent Bates from proceeding. But more on point with your question, sir, is when this case was revived in October of 2019, because the case was closed and the case was dormant. Reviewing the testimony from the motions practice, it's evident that the first thing that Agent Dunnigan did when he went to reacclimate himself with the case, and we can find this on page 407 of the record of the transcript, is that he goes back and reviews the false affidavit as his regenesis of the case. And at that point, he is entirely on notice that the evidence at issue was suppressed because of falsity.
Okay, but again, is there anything you can point to in terms of precedent that says that that's the correct standard that we should be applying here as compared to your sense that it was improper?
Your Honor, when we look at Agent Dunnigan in totality as it relates to Mr. Torre and the legal office, it is a fair conclusion to arrive at that this second search is still sufficiently tainted from the primary illegality. And the thrust of that primary illegality is the falsity. And there are multiple entities that are inherently bound up in that falsity. One of those entities is the legal office in this case. The legal office is tainted in this case, and that is not sufficiently dissipated when we get to the second search. The legal office is tainted in this case for several reasons. First, the judge advocate who was on the telephone for the first search authorization heard the false information, did nothing to prevent that information from being considered on its face. Second, that same judge advocate had a conversation with Agent Bates about the false language before the verbal attestation was put into written form and told the agent that it was permissible to go forward with false information.
But counsel, doesn't all that go to the first suppression? Isn't that the very reason why the evidence was initially suppressed? How does all that have to do with the second time around? The fact that you seem to be suggesting that the mere fact that individuals knew that the evidence had been suppressed is somehow taints them. And I think the issue here is whether or not this is derivative evidence under Wong's son. So if you could maybe explain to me how the agent the second time around actually exploited the illegally obtained DNA, which isn't that what's the thing that's illegal about the first one? It was suppressed because it was illegally obtained. So Wong Sung and those line of cases seem to prohibit exploitation of the illegality. So can you be kind of more specific and explain from your point of view how you think they exploited the illegality, how they exploited the suppressed DNA?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's precisely the point. Starting with this core fact in the record that Agent Bates lied under oath to the magistrate, and there's all these players involved in the second search were also there the first time. That reliability, that veracity, the things that courts use to review whether a magistrate had a substantial basis
But the magistrate the second time, or the military judge who they used as a search authority, he or she didn't have any knowledge of any of it, right? Isn't the problem with the case now is that the military judge, the new search authority, kind of came in with a clean slate. And so how would the military judge have been influenced by this other suppressed evidence if he or she was never informed of it?
Yes, Your Honor. The issue is, and the concern is that the military judge who acted as the search authority for Search 2 did not get the appropriate information. He got false information as well as misleading information, and there was material omissions in the information that got to him. So the second search authority was deprived the opportunity to have a substantial basis under the totality of the circumstances to determine whether or not there was probable cause.
All right, well, let's hear why you think the search authority didn't receive, what information that you think he should have received that he didn't, or in your case, the omissions, either one.
Yes, Your Honor. So information that he did not receive that he should have, the omissions. Agent Dunnigan omitted at least four critical facts. The first is that Airman Larrabee, or JL, told the sexual assault nurse examiner that she was clothed when she woke up.
Now, with that, if we can, before, let's go through each of the points you're about to make here. In that regard, to what extent should we be mindful of the fact that the saying was not transcribing the conversation with JL, but was instead providing a broad overview of the gist of the conversation?
Your Honor, regardless of the fact that the nurse examiner was transcribing the information she was receiving as she was receiving, and it's not a verbatim transcript, the underlying fact is surely material, and here's why. The standard for materiality for the omissions is if an officer withholds a fact in his kin that any reasonable person would know, a judge would want to know. And that standard comes from United States versus Cowgill. This court's opinion in 2010, it pulls it from federal case law from the Third Circuit. Whether or not JL was clothed is something a judge would like to know in evaluating the totality of the circumstances, whether it's reasonable that a penetrative crime was committed.
Well, isn't the question what the second magistrate got and whether it was sufficient for probable cause, not whether he got everything? You seem to be spreading this quarantine net a long way. Are you saying that nobody in the legal office could have anything to do with this thing the second time around, or what?
Your Honor, we're not saying that the legal office should have been entirely cut off from
a Chinese wall down the middle of the legal office with some on the one side, not some on the other. What are you saying?
Your Honor, the judge advocates who were principally involved in providing false information the first time ought not to have been involved the second time. That's one point, Your Honor. Another is utilizing a USASIL analyst, Mr. Mark Torre, who tested the samples in March of 2019. He knew the results of those tests. He then provided an intentional false statement as an affiant in support of the second search authorization.
What was that statement?
The false statement that Mr. Torre included in his affidavit is that pursuant to his testing, he obtained a result that matched a vaginal swab of Airman Larrabee, JL, senior airman Connor Gallagher, or he's referenced as CG, and an unidentified male. That is a false statement because Mr. Torre never conducted a test where the result from that test was JL plus CG plus identified. He knew that Airman Garcia was the third source of DNA in this case. Therefore, it was intentional.
He might have known, but you seem to be suggesting that the analyst affidavit should have included the fact that the analyst knew that the previous evidence had been suppressed and that he had done an examination or analysis that suggested, or at least proved, that the semen he found in the swab was the accused. But if that information had gone to the new search authority, wouldn't the search authority be tainted at that point? Wouldn't that be a problem?
Yes, Your Honor, it would be a problem, and there sort of lies the larger problem that we're grappling with in this
case.
Right,
but the only option is that you don't have the analyst submitted anything at all. His affidavit should not have been considered at all, is what you might be saying, right?
That's certainly one option, Your Honor. Uh-huh. Another option would have been for another analyst or another lab to use the lawfully obtained samples, conduct a test, and actually receive a result that says JL plus CG plus identified.
Right, but the lab's not associated with the prosecution, is it? I mean, they have a protocol for doing these things. At least I think that's what the analyst testified to, did he not? Do we know that he could have simply... Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead and answer the question. I want to... Judge Sparks, have you had your previous question answered?
No, I was getting ready to kind of finish it up here.
No, go ahead.
Do we know whether or not the analyst at the lab even had the ability to say, no, I think somebody else should do this? He didn't testify about that, did he?
The government's decision, Your Honor, to go back to the same analyst who knew the results of the first case and was aware of a suppression, and asking him to provide information in support of a search authority, knowing that such truthful information could not be accurately provided, does circle us back to the initial concern that we have individuals who are intimately familiar with suppressed information. And where this fear of a harm that could be consummated becomes actually consummated, involves a two-step process. The first is he then takes an affirmative step to be an arm of law enforcement and try to obtain these next samples. But second, once he gets these samples in October, he tests them again. He reaches back into the USACIL database and pulls out the results from the penile swab testing that had been conducted. The penile swab was suppressed evidence. Mr. Torre then uses suppressed evidence.
Yeah, I'm not going to make you use your time up. I do understand your point. And if the chief judge has a question, that's fine.
Well, I have no question.
If I have anything else on this point, maybe we can follow it up on your rebuttal.
Any other questions?
Just one here. You said you earlier on you had 4 points of information that were the subject of the taint that went forward. And my question is, are those 4 points of information that went forward to the second hearing, or are they simply 4 incidents in which people who participated in the first search also participated in the second, or is there a mix?
Yes, Your Honor. And Chief Judge Stuckey, with your permission, I can turn out or I can hold it for the rebuttal period.
Okay. Fine.
At your discretion.
Is that okay?
Rebuttal's fine.
Please address it in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Chief Judge Suki, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Kelsey Schuss, and along with Colonel Sean Speranza, I represent the United States. After a night of heavy drinking, Airman J.L. woke up in the middle of the night to appellant, in her own words, trying to have sex with her. Airman J.L. told investigators she was certain it was appellant because appellant identified himself, saying his name, and Airman J.L. recognized his face. Appellant was pretty much on top of Airman J.L., and Airman J.L. didn't know if she had clothes on, but she was pretty sure.
Yes, can we do this? I think we're all fairly familiar with the facts. Fortunately, we have good law clerks who allow us to do so. Can we get right to the issue that is at hand about, number one, the omitted evidence that you heard your colleague over here talking about, and then the issue of derivative evidence, that the second search is too derivative of the first to be independent?
Yes, Your Honor, we can.
I mean, if you want to include facts that go into that, that's fine. That's fine.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm happy to start with the analysis for derivative evidence under the law, because the military judge did abuse her discretion because she fundamentally did not understand what constitutes derivative evidence under the law. And like Judge Olson pointed out to the appellant, there's a distinction between evidence that's fruit of a poisonous tree and grows from that tree, and as the appellant and the military judge would have this court find, evidence that simply tainted because of guilt by association.
Let me ask you at that point, and then you can continue on. Counsel makes a point that, wait a minute, why were any of these people involved? Why didn't the government just start with a complete clean slate? Go get a different investigator who's not associated with the case and let that person review the evidence and go forward with the actual request for authorization. And then why not go get a different analyst who hasn't been associated with the case and let that person do an independent analysis to determine the outcome of the DNA? So what about that?
That's simply not what the law requires. And in this case, the evidence itself, the information about Airman J.L.'s initial report and the information that Senior Airman C.G. provided had no relationship whatsoever to the alleged illegality in this case. The only reason...
Well, some relationship. He was with the agent during the initial course of the investigation, was he not?
Yes, Your Honor. He was with the initial agent during the course of the investigation. But as the Air Force Court noted, the information that was provided only by Agent B alone. Agent B alone misinformed the first authorizing official.
And you heard Judge Olson's question earlier. I think Judge Olson and I, maybe others, were taking from counsel's argument that somehow Agent D, let's call him, was complicit with Agent B in the forming and developing of this false information that resulted in suppression of the DNA the first time around. What do you got to say to that?
Your Honor, he was not.
Does the record support it?
No, Your Honor.
I mean, does the evidence support the fact that he had no involvement with B's actual formulation of her affidavit to include this false information?
The record does not support that conclusion.
And what about later on when the agent realizes that she did give false information to the search authority? Did Agent D know about that conversation between the Chief of Military Justice and Special Agent B at all?
The record is silent to that, Your Honor.
All right.
Well, counsel, let's assume that that knowledge was there, that is, that the second agent knew everything that the first agent knew. Do you have an argument as to whether that does or does not taint the search in this case on the specific pieces of evidence that were used for the search?
Even if Agent R.D. knew, it would not taint the second search because the second search was based on evidence that was already available, and it was provided to a neutral, detached military judge who conducted an independent probable cause analysis.
And is that suggesting your view is that even if everything was tainted, and even if all the things that were omitted should have been in, this evidence alone, the evidence that was independently derived, is sufficient for probable cause and sustaining the search in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. The evidence that was available was sufficient to support probable cause, as probable cause is defined under the military rules of evidence and precedents from the Supreme Court and this court. It is a low bar.
And could you identify, assuming everything else should not have been considered, what specific pieces of evidence you're relying on now to sustain probable cause in this case?
If we assume that the information was recklessly provided or that falsely provided to the military judge, then we still have probable cause based on Airman JL's statements from her first and second interviews, from Airman CG's information that he provided in his second interview, and from the DNA evidence that was found within Airman JL's vaginal swab and revealed the presence of two male contributors. All of that information was provided to the second authorizing official, who again was a military judge. And this court has asked some questions about where the military judge, the trial judge, got confused here and has looked to where the appellant is getting this standard of derivative evidence. And I think if we look to the military judge's ruling, we see that she has a principle in paragraph 53 that says that evidence must actually be obtained through an independent and voluntary acts of third parties. That is a standard of law that she misapplies, because that standard of evidence is looking to whether witness testimony is derivative evidence of a unlawful search, and whether a witness has used their independent free will to come forward. That does not mean that evidence itself is going to be derivative. So the standard that the military judge has used and the standard that appellant has relied on improperly conducts what amounts to a conflicts analysis, when what we're looking at is whether the illegality itself has been exploited, as Judge Sparks said. The illegality here was that the first agent misrepresented facts. It was nothing related to the veracity of the facts themselves that were provided. And it's important to note, as we're looking at the derivative evidence analysis, that the fundamental question here is whether the exclusionary rule is going to serve its purpose in deterring improper law enforcement conduct. And this court should not find, as the Air Force Court similarly did not find, that the government should be put in a worse position based on misconduct of agents. The government is supposed to rely on the legal processes under the Fourth Amendment. But if the government makes a mistake or a rule is violated, the law still requires that we look to whether there is a proper balance between the court's ability to ascertain the truth and not put the government in a worse position.
Counsel, would you be willing to please address the military judge's position that the military judge, who was the person who granted the search authorization, was entitled to a quote-unquote complete picture? And the military judge's, I'll refer to her as the trial judge for clarity's sake, the trial judge's position that it was improper to quote-unquote cherry-pick facts?
Yes, Your Honor. This court should find, like the Air Force Court, that amounts to an erroneously heightened standard of probable cause, because what the military judge, the trial judge, is doing in that case is using probable cause to be measured against what she had previously suppressed. So the military judge is not reviewing and giving deference to the second search. She is considering the second search in light of all of the other facts that she knows were previously misrepresented.
I'm asking something a little bit different. She was looking at the omissions from the affidavit that went to the military judge who served as the search authorization official. And she stated that the military judge was entitled to a complete picture. How does this court draw a line between stating that a person granting search authorization is entitled to be fully informed of all relevant facts as compared to this idea of a complete picture? How do we draw a line between cherry-picking facts in terms of anytime anyone gives a narrative, you're cherry-picking facts? How do we draw the line between improper choosing of facts to present to a person who's going to grant, who's being asked to grant search authorization, as compared to not providing the information that is required to make an informed decision about a search?
Your Honor, this court has highlighted in Mason, for example, that it's a hard distinction to determine whether an agent is negligently excluding information or is doing so with a reckless disregard for the truth. But this court has previously relied on the Fourth Circuit case of United States versus Coakley, and that provides input on exactly the problem that you're identifying, Your Honor, because it highlights that for omissions in particular, it presents a tough question for officers to be subjected to endless conjecture about fragments of information that they included or investigative leads or other matters that might have redounded to the defendant's benefit if it would have been included. So in order to distinguish what omissions are material or not, this court should look to the Ninth Circuit case that the appellant has provided in Perkins, where in that case the court determined that there was a clear intentional pattern to selectively include information specifically to bolster probable cause. Because it's not enough just that facts might be left on the cutting room floor when an affidavit is drafted. The facts that are omitted must specifically seek to usurp the magistrate's duty to perform an independent legal analysis. So there is an element of intent that has to be considered when you're looking at whether omissions themselves are the kind that should be suspect under the Fourth Amendment.
When you're saying that intent is part of this, why does that matter as compared to if the agent who is involved knows a fact but overlooks it, and that fact is material? Anyone, a neutral and detached person looking at it, would say that's material in the sense that it would have affected the decision-making of the decision-maker. Why does it matter what the intent was? Why is that an undue burden on the defense at that point to prove that?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court in Franks versus Delaware had two prongs to their analysis on what should be considered. It required some level of intentionality and materiality, both. For omissions, it gets more difficult because you're automatically going to be deciding what facts to include and what facts not to include. But that conduct still must be flagrant, and that's language that this court has used previously in United States versus Cowgill. So when we're looking at the conduct of the agent in this case, we know that he did not act with a reckless disregard for the truth because we have the record developed as to all of the steps he took to ensure that facts were included. He did look at the initial and wrongly drafted affidavit, but then he also reconsidered all of the evidence. He prepared an affidavit himself. He took it to the legal office. They suggested he add things. He added more things only after verifying those facts to be true himself. And then he signed it.
May I ask a question? Is it standard practice nowadays to highlight or underline key facts in an affidavit?
No, Your Honor.
Why? It's been a long time since I've been involved in that. Very long time. But that stuck out to me. It seemed odd that there was underlining of facts, and of particular concern, the underlining of the question that was posed to JL here that didn't have any foundation. What was going on there? Why wasn't that really improper?
Your Honor, the record isn't clear as to how that information was bolded and underlined and who did it, but it was included and it was provided to the trial judge, who is expected to use his own sense of judgment to evaluate what the words actually say. And I don't think it has any more bearing than if one of the parties before this court were to bold and underline statements or highlight notations to indicate that there's some emphasis to be added. There's still an obligation of that trial judge and the military judge who's reviewing the authorization to determine whether probable cause still exists. So when we look to the abuses of discretion that the Air Force Court found, we see very clearly that she misunderstood what constitutes unlawful derivative evidence under the law, and that she misapplied the standard of probable cause, using a false measuring stick from her previous suppression ruling, rather than looking at the search authorization to determine whether the face of the affidavit itself provided a reasonable belief that there would be evidence found in the place where the government wished to find. And to reiterate, the facts of this case include a woman, Airman JL, who was pretty sure that someone had sexually assaulted her against her will without her consent, and that person had identified himself by saying his name. This is exactly the kind of case where the government needs to use the Fourth Amendment to obtain probable cause to continue to seek to find evidence. The military judge abused her discretion when she suppressed the evidence, and this court should affirm the Air Force Court's finding.
Counsel, I have
Jeff.
Here. I think we have a little time. At several points in the brief, you mentioned the good faith exception, that the CCA had not ruled on it, and then later on that the judge erred with respect to the probable cause determination, which affected the good faith exception. But the good faith exception is not briefed in here. And so my question is, does this case stand or fall on probable cause?
No, Your Honor.
Well, if it hasn't been briefed, why is it not an appellate waiver in this case?
Although it has not been briefed, the military judge found that the good faith exception would not apply based on her determination of reckless disregard for the truth. So the military judge didn't even get to it because she abused her discretion as it relates to that particular finding.
I understand the point that you're making there, but what do we use to find that there was good faith in this case and that all of the standards set forth in our court's precedents plus Rule 311C have been followed? Do we have to make a new independent review of that without the briefing of the parties?
Your Honor, because the military judge abused her discretion, the Air Force Court didn't consider it. And to the extent that the record was developed on that, the parties didn't address it either, because the concern was whether the military judge was going to look at the agent's intent, whether it was false with reckless disregard.
Right. So my understanding of where we are now, and please amplify if I don't have it correctly, is that the government is relying on the probable cause determination here and not asking this court to make its own analysis of the good faith exception.
Your Honor, this court could find that the trial judge abused her discretion in many different ways and send this case back to the trial court for proceeding to trial. The military judge, as the Air Force Court noted, did not make findings of fact consistent with the record. this court could find that. This court could find that she misapplied the legal standard for false and reckless disregard and made an erroneous finding of fact that the agent was reckless. This court could find that she misunderstood the legal definition for probable cause and reverse her ruling on that grounds. So this court could make multiple determinations that the military judge erred and reverse her finding and send it back to the trial court.
I understand that. My question was solely about the good faith exception, whether the good faith exception is open to this court at this point in the manner in which this case has been presented and briefed.
Your Honor, my understanding is that this court, if this court is interested in resolving it simply on good faith, would have to return this case back to the trial court for a determination, because we don't have a finding of fact on that at this time.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Senior Judge Efron, I'd like to start this time addressing your question as my time expired. And that was about the four omissions in this second search authorization. And they do, all four, go to this second search. The first was that JL told the same that her clothes were on when she woke up. The second was an omission of anything from Airman Gallagher's first interview on 4 February of 2019. The third is that there was nothing about the prior suppression for intentional and reckless falsity. And the fourth is that there was an omission regarding the ex-boyfriend, Senior Airman Broadbeck, as a possible other source.
And which of those constitute evidence that was improperly derivative from the first search authorization proceeding and resulted in the presentation of tainted evidence? I understand your argument why that may or may not bear on probable cause, but in terms of taint, which of those involve a derivative taint?
Your Honor, as it pertains to taint, appellant relies on the involvement of Agent Dunnigan, the involvement of Mr. Torrey, and the involvement of the legal office with the falsity from the first search authorization as that propels its way forward. When we start talking about Mr. Torrey, we have an individual who quite literally utilized suppressed evidence in his October 2019 test. And by no means could the government now stand up and say when suppressed evidence is utilized that the taint of the illegality that led to the suppression is sufficiently dissipated. Now, Judge Olson, I'd like to respond to your question about the military judge's discussion on the full or complete picture. And no, this is not an erroneously heightened probable cause standard. What this is it's talking about the totality of the circumstances, which is the same probable cause test that the Supreme Court discussed in Gates and we've been using ever since. When we talk about the full picture or the complete picture, the discussion turns on whether the search authority had the information known at the time relevant to the determination. And when you have an agent who selectively includes facts that would tend to support probable cause and bold and underline them in order to draw emphasis, and at the exact same time omits any facts which would tend to detract from probable cause, that law enforcement agent has deprived the search authority the opportunity to fulfill their sacred duty to determine probable cause based on the totality of the circumstances, because the totality of the circumstances were not provided. That's the essence of the problem, in that the military judge acting as search authority did not have the information that he needed to.
In that regard, Do you view the Fourth Circuit case of Coakley as misstating the law? Do you think it is to be applied in a different way than the government anticipates, or how do you view Coakley?
Your Honor,
should not adopt it?
Your Honor, I think the better adoption for this court is to look at the Ninth Circuit case of Perkins. And that's a case involving a Franks hearing initially sent back from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, where ultimately the decision was made that the law enforcement agent selectively deprived the search authority the opportunity to make a full determination based on the totality. Similarly, in this case, Agent Dunnigan deprived Lieutenant Colonel Norton, the military judge acting as search authority, to do his job with the evidence that exists in this case. The decision in Perkins is to be directly applied to this case, and that case discusses that a search affiant may mislead a search authority by not providing all the relevant information at that time. Now, Your Honor also discussed in...
Your Honor, I have a question. I know counsel's time has run. My understanding, Captain Bosner, of the law with respect to omissions is that we take the affidavit at issue, and if we correct it by including the omissions that you say were improperly excluded, isn't the question at that point, do the omissions vitiate the conclusion of probable cause, right? And so could you spend not a whole minute, maybe half a minute, explaining why you think the inclusion, the four things that you consider as omissions, would have resulted in the military judge, who was the search authority, changing his or her conclusion? In other words, they would not have found probable cause had she or he known of these omissions.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's precisely...
First of all, let me ask you, is my understanding of the law correct?
Yes, Your Honor. This court's opinion in United States v. Mason, 2004, squarely addressed the hypothetical inclusion of omissions to do the probable cause analysis. So, mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor, that's absolutely correct. And in this case, when the omissions are hypothetically included, and maybe more importantly, the intentional falsity of an unidentified male is excluded, there's no probable cause remaining. And here's why. In the Air Force course analysis, it identifies facts from the evening that they know from the apartment. The court then attributes those facts to say it is now reasonable for the search authority to have concluded that these facts would support a reasonable inference that Airman Garcia is the unidentified male. The problem is that statement about the unidentified male must be excised because it's an intentional false statement. And what we have then is a set of discrete facts from the evening. We have our client in the apartment with Airman Gallagher and JL. There's some information provided by JL and some by CG. What's a critical omission that would change the probable cause analysis in total is the omission of any mention of Airman CG's first interview, where he says the appellant and JL were away for only 1 to 2 minutes. But what is included in the affidavit is what he said in the second interview, which is that they were actually gone for 10 to 20 minutes, thereby enlarging the period of time where this crime could be committed by tenfold. So especially when that material and critical omission is injected into the probable cause analysis, the DNA result of an unidentified male is excised, there is but bare facts to determine probable cause, and it is surely insufficient to sustain that finding.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. Honor. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court is in recess pending further order of the court.